From Brennan to the Boca Chiel, from Lummi to La Push, and from the lordly Sawduck to lovely Duckabush. From Samish to Sammamish, Suquamish to Quilicene, the climate is so friendly, it's a land that's evergreen.
Hello, and welcome to the History of the Evergreen State podcast. I'm your host, John C., and thank you for joining me today for episode 114, From Yakima City to Union Gap. When the Lewis and Clark expedition reached the confluence of the Yakima River with the powerful Columbia in the fall of 1805, Native Americans greeted them with hospitality. From the Yakima River's headwaters in the Cascade Range to its confluence with the Columbia River in the south, from the mountains into the vast flat areas of the valley, the ancestors of individuals the expedition visited had lived there for millennia. The peoples of the plateau collectively referred to themselves as hunters, gatherers, fishermen, and traders. One of the numerous tribes that made up the vast but dispersed Indian nation east of the Cascades was the Yakimas. The Pishwanapum, the Squanana, and, in the neighborhood of what would eventually become the town of Yakima City, the Paquita Kutlima, were among the bands and tribes that made up the indigenous cultures. All of them spoke Shahapshin in addition to their own languages. It is quite possible that non-Indians were introduced to those living along the Yakima River's course even before Lewis and Clark arrived, but the majority of early migrants stayed close to the main waterways of the Snake and Columbia Rivers to the east and south. Several explorers, including trappers, prospectors, and traders, entered the Yakima territory after the Corps of Discovery had proceeded. As early as 1812, the renowned Hudson's Bay Company had workers in the region. They would remain there occasionally, but for many years to come, non-native encounters in the Yakima Valley would be scant and infrequent. The Roman Catholic Church was the first semi-permanent non-Indian presence in the Yakima Valley, as it was in many other locations. Eugene Casimir Chareuse and Charles Marie Pandacy, Oblate Catholic missionaries, are believed to have arrived in the region for the first time in 1848, despite conflicting histories that are currently available. General George B. McClellan's mapping mission up the Yakima River in 1853 marked the beginning of an American military incursion into the territory. Fort Simcoe was built in 1856, 25 miles southwest of what would become Yakima. The fort was a part of the federal government's strategy to appease the local Indians and fundamentally alter their way of life. According to all accounts, the local Indians were not hostile toward non-natives who had just arrived from a world they had little knowledge of. That would change when officials made the decision to uproot the tribes from a large portion of their original territory in order to distribute it to the swelling number of settlers moving west. Even tribes that had remained friendly with settlers suddenly had to make awful decisions, one of which was to engage in combat. The people who currently reside on the enormous Yakima Reservation, which comprises more than 62% of the entire area of Yakima County, are the descendants of numerous formerly independent bands and tribes. With the arrival of settlers and the imposition of treaties, what had been separate bands bound by blood and language were forcibly consolidated into somewhat arbitrary groups. The first governor of Washington Territory and superintendent of Indian Affairs, Isaac Stevens, was to play a key role in the effort by the government to isolate the tribes in the Northwest. Although at times his own attitudes toward the native people were conflicted and devoid of warmth and respect, his mission left little room for emotion or the consideration of Indian preferences. So, Stevens began to seize their ancestral lands and relocate them to reservations that were almost always too small or inappropriate in character. He did this with cunning and a certain amount of cruelty. Yakima Chief Kamiakin would represent his people in the negotiating of the Walla Walla Treaty in 1855. He was a strong, wealthy, and charismatic leader. Kamiakin was one of the most gorgeous and well-shaped Indians they had met, according to Army Explorer Lieutenant Robert E. Johnson, but he was also gruff and cantankerous and refused to sell Johnson's company any horses. Kamiakin, often spelled Kamiakun or Kamiakin, demonstrated his leadership abilities in a variety of ways. He created the first artificial irrigation system in the Yakima Valley, a half-mile-long trench he dug from a spring to his garden plots east of modern-day Union Gap. It was known as Kamiakin's Ditch by the early settlers, and it may have been this that helped them to discover that what initially appeared to be parched, bunchgrass-dominated land just needed some water to become rich and very productive. The so-called Kamiakin's Garden is now listed on the National Register of Historic Places and is situated on private property east of Union Gap. Stevens and Kamiakin decided to meet in May of 1855 in Walla Walla. Father Pandacy had specifically and firmly warned him about the hopelessness of attempting to protect ancestral territories from white intrusion. Kamayakin gathered with other native elders along the Grand Round River prior to the Stevens meeting to devise a plan to map out their own ancestral territories and then refused to yield any of them to Stevens or to anyone else. The inhabitants of the plateau decided to draw the boundaries of their own reservations while the settlers were free to travel wherever they pleased. Naturally, it was not meant to be. In May, near Mill Creek, the Walla Walla Treaty Council convened, and Kamayakin's coalition disintegrated very quickly. Other strong bands and tribes, like the Nez Perce, made the decision to follow their own paths. Long-standing rivalries, jealousies, and mistrust precluded native coherence. Thus, Stevens bargained, if it can be called such a thing, with divided and disheartened tribes. The treaty negotiations continued until June. As one of the principal holdouts, Kamayakin remained adamant. Stevens tried bribery and flattery without success. A source claims that Stevens may have then started using threats. Kamayakin only bowed to Stevens's pressure when he displayed his own draft of a treaty and threatened to walk in blood knee-deep if they didn't sign. The Indian Wars started in the Northwest not long after the Walla Walla Treaty and other unjust agreements were signed. At Toppenish Creek and Union Gap, the first two battles of the Yakima Indian War took place. He was never imprisoned or defeated, in contrast to numerous tribal chiefs and war chiefs. A.J. Splawn, a historian who had a close relationship with Kamayakin, thought that the Yakima chief was motivated to personally kill Isaac Stevens because he thought his death would bring an end to the war and the restitution of native lands. Therefore, Stevens was fortunate that Kamayakin's plans could not be carried out, but Stevens's good fortune would eventually run out. He died in 1862 while commanding Union troops at the Battle of Chantilly in the American Civil War. After 3 years of intermittent conflict, the Indian Wars came to a conclusion in 1858 when Kamayakin, then in his late 50s, took part in the final two significant battles, the Battle of Four Lakes and its follow-up, the decisive Battle of Spokane Plains. With his power and influence essentially exhausted and his once impressive wealth dissipating, Kamayakin eventually became an exile who moved from camp to camp with a steadily shrinking circle of supporters. His health was slowly deteriorating. In the Palouse Scablands near Rock Lake, far from his ancestral homeland, is where he passed away in April of 1887, reportedly one day after being baptized into the Catholic faith and given the Christian name Matthew. A relic hunter dug up Kamayakin's body the following year and took his head, so he was to endure one final insult. The head was never recovered. The remainder of his body was relocated and reburied. Thousands of acres of land in central Washington were made available for future settlement after the majority of Indians were relocated to reservations. Fielding Mortimer Thorpe, who arrived in the Moxie Valley a few miles east of what would become Union Gap in October of 1860, was the first long-term non-native settler in the valley. Thorpe, who specialized in raising cattle, brought a sizable herd with him from his former ranch in the Kittitas Valley. Thorpe preserved many of his cattle over the harsh winter of 1861-62, stayed put, and flourished. The town of Thorpe and Thorpe Peak are both named for the family. He, his wife Margaret, and their 8 children would be essentially the only non-native inhabitants in the Yakima Valley for many years. The Saxons, Splawns, and Hensons were among the families who homesteaded in the valley in the early 1860s after the Thorpes, though none of them made Union Gap their permanent residence. The short-lived Ferguson County, which had covered a large portion of the same territory for 2 years, was disestablished by the Washington Territorial Assembly on the 21st of January, 1865, and Yakima County was subsequently created. The Simcoe Mountains, the Cascade Mountains, the Wenatchee River, and the Columbia River from below Wallula to Wenatchee formed the southern, western, northern, and eastern boundaries of the new county. Later, in 1865, a wagon train headed for Puget Sound took a detour from the primary westward track and traveled up the Yakima River from where it converged with the Columbia. The settlers, under the direction of Dr. L.H. Goodwin, arrived at Union Gap, a void between two hills, and made the decision not to continue on any further. Additional guests were Goodwin's wife and kids, his nephew Thomas, the families of Walter Lindsay and John Roselle, as well as Roselle's son-in-law William Harrington. On the 18th of December, 1865, Goodwin's wife Priscilla passed away and was buried on a neighboring rock with a view of the Yakima River. Her husband later donated this land to the city, and it became the location of Pioneer Cemetery, which is still in use today, although he later relocated to Walla Walla before passing away there. When more immigrants flowed in, Dr. Goodwin constructed what he named the Spring Creek Homestead. Sumner Barker, an early settler, founded the first store in what would become Yakima City in 1869, and one of the doctor's 3 sons, George Goodwin, opened another in 1870. A portion of George Goodwin's homestead allotment was officially platted and documented in 1872 under the name Yakima City. Additional families were dispersed around the valley, but they weren't in enough large-sized clusters to become recognizable settlements. Teaching valley children began in 1870 thanks to Martha Goodwin Beck, Dr. Goodwin's sister. Brothers Charles and Joseph Shano relocated to the valley from the Dalles, Oregon that same year, and they started a third, larger store in Yakima City. On acres of dry, sagebrush-covered land that the Shanos claimed as their own, a little town called Yakima City started to take shape. There would soon be held the first sessions of the Yakima County Territorial Court, with Judge J.R. Lewis presiding. Except for the areas close to rivers and streams, the majority of the Yakima Valley at the time was still considered to be too dry for cultivation. Early in 1866, members of the Goodwin Party excavated a minor irrigation canal, but the Shano brothers did not begin digging a larger ditch from Autanum Creek to Yakima City until 1872, though other sources suggest it might have been 1870. That same year, John Beck began planting fruit trees on his property and constructed a canal from the Yakima River. His efforts met with surprising success. A considerably larger canal, 18 feet wide and 18 inches deep, was excavated by the Shano brothers 2 years later. It spanned 9 miles from the Natchez River in the north to their homestead in Yakima City. Initially, the water was mostly utilized for vegetable gardens and a little amount of wheat production, but it was subsequently discovered that far larger areas of land could be irrigated to grow alfalfa, which would eventually become the county's main income crop. The western portion of the valley floor quickly became spiderwebbed with additional canals and ditches curated by other ambitious people, and the valley's full agricultural potential began to materialize. Even with this development, growth was meager. Just 2,000 people called Yakima County home in 1875, the year mail service was introduced to the area, and 15 years after Fielding Mortimer Thorpe established his homestead. The small town of Yakima City, which was the first in the entire valley despite its glacial growth, quickly dubbed itself the Giant of the West in the apparent expectation that it would come true. Although it wouldn't, the town did make several large advancements. The struggling small town's inhabitants knew that the Northern Pacific Railway was on its way and that it would bring access, success, and good fortune. It was believed that the railroad branch would end in Yakima City, which was still the county seat and the biggest town, after beginning at the Pasco Junction in the south and traveling up the Yakima River Valley. The municipality formed on the 1st of December 1883, hoping to become a significant station on the line. The town's few residents then patiently awaited the cruise laying track to appear on the horizon. On the 24th of December 1884, the Northern Pacific delivered its first train to Yakima City, carrying both passengers and freight, and placing a station agent there to oversee operations. It was short-lived, however, as the railroad filed a plat for a location in the middle of nowhere a few miles outside of Yakima City on the 4th of February 1885. North Yakima was the subsequent name given to this new town. The Northern Pacific would extend its rails to this location and construct a depot and a town there. The railway simply just discontinued stopping at Yakima City. There's at least two or three alternate explanations as to why the Northern Pacific Railway made the decision to hand Yakima City what was almost certainly going to be a death sentence. Officially, the railroad claimed that the area around the small town would become unusable for railroad usage if full irrigation was put into place. According to some other versions of events, the community of Yakima City did not extend an adequate amount of generosity to the railroad in exchange for the establishment of a depot in town. A third point of view was that the railroad just desired to found a new town, one that it could exercise complete control over from the beginning. Regardless of the motivation, the citizens of Yakima City did not take the slight lying down. The local populace was successful in persuading the territorial administration to bring legal action against the railroad, which was subsequently heard by the Supreme Court in due time. In the meantime, the railroad actively developed North Yakima by providing free lots to anyone moving from Yakima City, constructing a municipal water system, and designing a town plan that was purportedly laid out on the general plan of Baden-Baden, which is a spa town located in Germany. The case of Northern Pacific Arco versus Washington Territory took 7 years to make its way to the United States Supreme Court, and by the time it did so, the circumstances on the ground had shifted in a manner that was no longer recognizable. The ruling of the court provides a condensed summary of the negative effects that Yakima City experienced as a result of the loss of the railroad. The defendant, Northern Pacific Railway, at one time stopped its trains at Yakima City, but never built a station there, and, after completing its road 4 miles further to North Yakima, established a freight and passenger station there, which was a town laid out by the defendant on its own unimproved land, and thereupon ceased to stop its trains at Yakima City. In consequence, Yakima City, which was the most important town in population and business in the county, rapidly dwindled and most of its inhabitants were moved to North Yakima, which at the time of the verdict had become the largest and most important town in the county. The record showed that the district court proceeding in the case was held at Yakima City, but at the time of rendering judgment was held at North Yakima, to which the county seat and the courthouse had been moved. The outlook was gloomy, to say the least. Yakima City experienced a decline of population of more than two-thirds in just a few short months, going from more than 500 residents to less than 150. The power play that the railroad appeared to be pulling off looked to be planned to bring about the total obliteration of the earliest established town in the Yakima Valley, which was also the first county seat in Yakima County and was about to lose even that final distinction. The railroad was found guilty of wrongdoing by the territorial district court, and the territorial Supreme Court affirmed the district court's ruling. The railroad was given the option of either moving its station to Yakima City or completely relocating to North Yakima. Either option was not really acceptable for the railroad. The railroad company filed an appeal, but in the interim, they loosely complied with the lower court's verdict. They moved more than 100 structures on horse-drawn rollers from Yakima City to the brand new North Yakima, leaving the old town almost empty. Yakima City, established by hardy and determined pioneers, shrank and became less powerful, while North Yakima, which had been conceived of by nameless railroad functionaries the day before yesterday, expanded and became more powerful. It may have appeared as though the railroad was being charitable by moving the old town to the new location at no cost, but in reality, it served the railroad's goals by relieving it of the need to carry out a significant amount of construction at the new location. The matter had already been rendered factually moot by the time the appeal of the railroad was reviewed by the United States Supreme Court. Yakima City was falling into disrepair while North Yakima was thriving, and there was practically nothing that could be done about it. The fact that the Supreme Court reversed the decision of the lower courts and found in favor of the railroad was only significant insofar as the decision could serve as a precedent for the adjudication of future legal disputes. The justices of the Supreme Court did not all reach the same conclusion, though. There were three who disagreed with the majority opinion, and one of them was the famous jurist John Marshall Harlan. The dissent presented the issues in their true light, which were as follows. A railroad company builds its road into a county, finds the county seat already established and inhabited, the largest and most prosperous town in the county, and along the line of its road for many miles. It builds its road to and through that county seat. There is no reason of a public nature why that should not be made a stopping place. For some reason undisclosed, perhaps because that county seat will not pay to the managers a bonus, or because they seek a real estate speculation in establishing a new town, it locates its depot on the site of a paper town, the title to which it holds contiguous to this established county seat, stops only at the one and refuses to stop at the other, and thus, for private interests, builds up a new place at the expense of the old. And for this subservience of its public duty to its private interest, we are told that there is in the courts no redress. The author of the dissenting opinion concluded, "I do not so belittle the power or duty of the courts." In response to the reasoning of the majority that the courts could not compel the train to stop at Yakima City because Congress had not specifically specified the town as a required stopping location. This rationale said that the courts could not compel the railroad to halt at Yakima City simply pissed off the few folks that remained in the dwindling town. This was the perfect example of the old phrase, too little and too late. Yakima City, founded by early settlers, would decline to the point that its existence was threatened by North Yakima, which it would go on to expand and prosper. It wouldn't be long before it even lost its own name. North Yakima had explosive growth due to its proximity to both the railroad and it being named the county seat. According to the results of the federal census conducted in 1890, the total population of Yakima County was just 4,420 people. After another 10 years, in 1900, the number had more than tripled, reaching 13,462. During the same time period, the population of North Yakima increased by 105%, reaching 3,154 people. On the other hand, the census taken in 1890 revealed that there were only 196 people living in Yakima City, which was a municipality that had more than 500 citizens only 5 years prior. But Yakima City would live on, and in the next decades, it would even have something resembling a slow-motion comeback of sorts. In the year 1900, the population was recorded as being 287, but it took until 1930 for the town to achieve the level it had reached before the railroad came. There would be one more humiliation in the end. By the year 1910, the population of North Yakima had skyrocketed to over 14,000, while that of Yakima City had fallen back to 263. The proximity of two cities using the name Yakima began to rankle and confuse people. The name of Yakima City was formally changed to Union Gap in 1917 by an act of the Washington State Legislature, and it has stayed that way ever since. On the 1st of January the following year, North Yakima officially changed its name to just Yakima, signifying that it became the only town in the area to use that name. More than half a century after Dr. Goodwin's wagon train stopped at the gap in the hills that separates the lower Yakima Valley from the upper valley, the town that he helped build would eventually adopt the name of that topographical feature. In the words of a report that appeared in a current newspaper, the old territorial town of Yakima City, which had been granted a legislative charter in 1883, was completely removed from the map, and in its place, Union Gap was established. 5 years after Yakima City was renamed Union Gap, a brief piece published in a newspaper in Seattle provided some insight into how outsiders felt about the area. "So many motorists have passed through the town of Union Gap without knowing there was a town in sight until they were hailed by a traffic officer and then hauled to court, that complaints have been made time and again to the commercial club here by outraged tourists." The same article, in an attempt to add insult to injury, referred to Union Gap, which was the first county seat and oldest settlement in all of Yakima County, as the infant town. As time went on, Yakima expanded to the point that it became the most populous city in Yakima County, the second most populous city in eastern Washington, and the eighth most populous city in the state. Its borders grew in all directions, and in due time, the line that had served as a geographical barrier between that city and Union Gap evolved into more of a political limit, with the northern reaches of the smaller town merging in with the southern boundary of the larger metropolis. And just as their borders fused, so too did a significant portion of their history. Even though they have different governments, school districts, and some services, these two cities are often considered to be one large municipality, despite the fact that their names indicate that they are two separate cities. Despite this, the people who lived in Union Gap did everything they could to preserve their autonomy in the face of the overlord to the north. A $23,000 bond issue to create a modern municipal water system was approved by the people of the town in 1935 by a majority of 194-18 votes. Prior to this, the town's residents relied on individual wells for their water supply. In addition, on the 3rd of November 1937, 14 citizens of the community got together to form the Union Gap Volunteer Fire Department in order to better defend their neighborhood from the ever-present threat of fire. It is still in operation today and additionally offers a variety of other urgent care services. At an average elevation of 975 feet above sea level, Union Gap spans over a total area of just 5 square miles. By 1940, the population had nearly reached 1,000 people. By 1960, it had reached 2,100. By 1980, it had swelled to 3,184, and the population was tallied at 6,047 in the census taken in 2010. Today, the population of Union Gap is approximately equally composed of males and females, and 47.2% of the population identifies as Hispanic. Although it is considered its own autonomous city under state law, the Growth Management Act of the state classifies it together with Yakima as a single urban growth area for the purposes of regional planning. In 2012, the citizens of Union Gap cast ballots to decide whether or not to switch from a mayor-council form of government to a city-manager type of government. Over the course of its history, Union Gap has had the typical level of criminal activity and controversy associated with small towns, but nothing of sufficient notoriety to garner coverage in the media outlets further afield than the local press. Since 2001, there have only been two reported homicides within the boundaries of the city. The economy of the town operates in a manner that is mostly similar with that of the valley, the state, and the country as a whole. Because of this, the town suffered alongside other areas of the country and the state during the significant economic upheavals of its history, such as the Panic of 1893, the Great Depression, and the Great Recession of the late 2000s. The Elizabeth Loudon Carmichael House, which can be found at 108 West Pine Street, the Alexander McAllister House, which can be found at 402 West White Street, and Kamiakin's Garden, which can be found just outside of the town's eastern boundary, are all included on the National Register of Historic Places. In addition, the town is home to the Central Washington Agricultural Museum, which is located in Fulbright Park. The museum has exhibits on the history of farming in the valley, as well as collections of historic farm equipment. Rock music is likely the industry that has contributed the most to the city's notoriety in areas that are not immediately adjacent to it. Gary Puckett was born in 1942 and spent his childhood in Yakima. He is most known for forming the band Gary Puckett and the Union Gap in the 1960s. They went on to have a number of hits, the most successful of which was Young Girl, which topped the charts in 1968. When the Northern Pacific Railway abandoned Union Gap when it was still in its infancy, the town had every reason to just fade away. It would have been simple to just give up all pretense of separate life and become a part of the quickly rising metropolis of Yakima. This would have been the easiest option. However, the people who lived there refused to give up what they had labored so hard to establish, and as a consequence, the town is still around to this day. It has learned to thrive by offering services to the communities that surround it. On the third weekend of every August, the community hosts the Central Washington Antique Farm Exposition, as well as the Old Town Days event, to commemorate both the history of agriculture in the Yakima Valley, as well as its own lengthy history. Union Gap has persisted despite significant challenges, and it still maintains a title that can never be taken away from it. It was the first town in Yakima County. If you're enjoying the show, please leave a 5-star review, and don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss a new episode. Doing so really helps the show to grow and to expand to a new audience, so any help that you can give in that regard will be greatly appreciated. Sources for this episode include Atlas Obscura, the Yakima County Historical Society, Washington Rural Heritage, Washington State University Archives, HistoryLink.org, The Spokesman Review, NewspaperArchive.com, the Yakima Chamber of Commerce, Weird Washington by Jeff Davis and Al Euphrasio, Roadside America, and History of the Yakima Valley, Washington, Volume 1 by W.D. Lyman. Thank you for listening to episode 114, From Yakima City to Union Gap. Episode 115 will be released next week and will be the start of the spooky season on the podcast. All October long, there will be episodes about shipwrecks and murders, robberies, and kidnappings. So be sure to check those out as they drop every Wednesday night at 9 p.m. A special thanks goes out to Al Hirsch for providing the music for the podcast. If you have any questions about the show, please contact historyoftheevergreenstatepod@gmail.com. Thank you once again for listening to another episode of the History of the Evergreen State podcast. And until next time, I'm your host, John C.
There's peace on the Skokomish, on the Queets, and on the Ho. There's calm on the Nisqually, born of ageless ice and snow. A land that nature loves so much, she stays the whole year round. I trade a royal palace for a shack on Puget Sound. There's Chimicum and Stillicum, where spouts the gooey duck, the singing Stillaguamish and the swirling Skookumchuck, and Moclips and Copalis, where the razor clams abound. Little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound. A little bit of heaven is a shack on Puget Sound.